And today, Labor Day, I'm delighted to welcome to the program Hal Bolton. He is the author of the book War Myths in the Workplace, Ride the Edge of Chaos to a Peaceful Revolution. He has an extensive career in both labor and management, has worked in many positions and consulted for years with the Kaizen Institute of America and many schools and nonprofits as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, war myths in the workplace. What is an example of a war myth?
War myths are built around anybody is the enemy except myself or my corporation, depending upon where you're working. It's competitive. Corporations use war myths to define their competition as the enemy. They will use subterfuge, intelligence to get the best of the other corporation, and it's all around how do we win.
It's interesting that when Japan became a rising economic power, as you write about in your book, some of the Japanese war texts were actually introduced and became real texts for American capitalists.
Absolutely.
What are some examples of that, and what kind of lessons did they take from them?
Well, they were about how to fool your enemy, how to use subterfuge, how to cheat. They were based on the old samurai system of winning wars. What they didn't realize is the Japanese don't use those anymore.
Right.
They use a totally different method of working and working with their people.
One of the things that I think is central to the book is you write about different developmental stages and then apply those developmental stages, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, and so on, to the way groups operate. So it's not only a child acting childish, but you have adults within, for example, corporations acting very childish. What does this look like? How do you see that?
Well, I call it levels of awareness. Just because you're an adult does not mean you behave with adult awareness. We begin with childlike myths. We learn our myths. In adolescence, we live those myths. And sometimes we live the rest of our lives living those myths. Very common in the world today, very common in our country today, and very common in corporations, where the myths are about self-interest, myths are about win-lose. The way you solve problems is by conflict, is by violence or war, or dominance or power.
You gave this example about how when you were a child, when you were actually a child, one of your little playmates hit you over the head with a little rake, a little toy rake, and your mother said, you know, you went home crying, and your mother said, well, hit him back. So you take an iron crowbar, and if your mother hadn't intervened, you might have done total brain damage to this little playmate of yours.
That's childlike awareness.
And that's what people do when they go postal.
And I have seen, I've talked to workers, and I talked to one in one particular company, and he said he was not being respected. He said, I feel like going home and getting my Uzi and taking care of people. Well, that in fact has happened.
Taking care of, quote unquote.
Yes. And, you know, an Uzi is a submachine gun.
Right, right.
And he was so mad, he was ready to take that to work.
Now, it's interesting that in that example, it's actually your mom who taught you to do that.
Yes. That's where you learn the myths. Childlike, you learn the myths. Adolescent, you live those myths.
Now, what is the distinction between childlike responses and adolescent responses in the context of this study that you're doing?
Childlike depends on parental authority. So in many corporations, I've seen workers, and in my own corporation, say, just tell me what you want me to do. Now, that's child-parent relationship. Adolescents, you tend to work with a union, and you do how the union works, or you join a gang, or you join a fraternity, or you join an organization, and your identity moves from parental-family relationship to this group relationship. So you have an adolescent gang, you have an adolescent reactive union, or...
What's wrong with unions?
Nothing is wrong with unions. Unions were designed to be reactive because their members were not being treated with respect. So I respect unions hugely.
So it looks like, when you describe this, that the American corporate system is in many ways based on a combination of childish and adolescent developmental levels of awareness.
Absolutely.
And so...
And the myths that go with it, they're living with, these myths of economic self-interest, the win-lose myths, they are the enemy myths, those are all adolescents personified.
Right. And then there are alternatives to that, which is what we might call growing up.
We might call it growing up. Now, I differentiate physical growing up from awareness growing up. They are two totally different streams. So when a corporation begins to grow up, they begin to look at and communicate with their people, and they understand that what I'll call value added, and I can explain that in a minute, what value added is from the workers, not from the managers. Managers are all waste. They do not add value to the product. They may add direction, they may add other things, but in the true definition of value added, they are waste.
What do you mean? Let's talk about that for a second. What is value added?
Value added is the last turn of a screw to tighten two pieces together, is producing a piece that is ready to be added to another piece. It is changing a part from one state to a more finished state.
It's taking an apple off a tree and making applesauce and putting it in a jar and selling it.
That's value added.
And so managers don't add any value?
In the true definition of value added, they do not. They think they do, but who actually produces the product? The person on the shop floor, the person in the bakery, or the person in the, wherever, they are the ones that add value to the product. Now, what we call managers and those people is not value added but necessary. And a well-managed adult corporation minimizes the amount of non-value added but necessary. In Japan, probably the best corporation was Toyota, and they said their value added to non-value added was about 350 to 1. That is, for every value added unit, there were 350 units of not value added. Now, if I would look at it, American corporations, what I would find to the value added may be as high as 10,000 to 1. So that's why we became non-competitive in automobiles and in many other areas, because we were working from the top down instead of from the bottom up.
Do you feel that Toyota, for example, or other similar Japanese corporations provide an example of what, quote-unquote, adult awareness level and adult management looks like?
Yes and no. That's a complex situation. The workers are involved in day-to-day operations and decision-making. The direction still comes from the top, and sometimes too much from the top. In American companies that have adopted the Japanese system, the workers have more part in the decision-making and in the process improvement than some of the Japanese companies do, the good American companies. Most American companies, workers are considered, to use a war term, cannon fodder. They can be laid off, they can be fired, they can be coerced, they can be transferred. We can take our work and transfer it overseas. That is not considering workers or the workers' families or the communities.
And we're kind of creating a vicious cycle because in the United States, in so many places, our educational level is so bad. We just heard an interview about how functional adult illiteracy in New Mexico is around 50%. And so how can you expect to have a workforce of people making good decisions when they're not properly educated?
That's absolutely true. We had a process in Western New York of retraining workers that had been displaced by companies shutting down. And these workers had been in their job as a small steel mill for years and years, when we came out to talk about them retraining, we found that over 35% could not read or write. They had learned how to do their jobs by rote, but they could not read or write. And I have many other stories of similar nature. So education is absolutely the ground upon which you have to build an economy.
So if you have a company that is being run in a way that you think is, well, employing these adult levels of awareness, and basically what you're looking for is not war myths, but different kinds of myths, myths of treating each other in a fair and just manner, doing something productive, looking out for the community, looking out for each other. What does that look like at best?
Well, a company that I spent a lot of time with, who chose to be unnamed for whatever their reasons were, I went back and visited them 15 years after our first intervention with them, and they had progressed so much. I interviewed about 40 people there. They make a very precision product that uses tolerances that are in the microns. Now, a micron is a fraction of the diameter of a human hair. So very, very tight, very precise parts. On a brand new design, they made 3 million parts before they had a customer reject, and that reject was a labeling error. I also talked to the people about their involvement in the community. Every employee I talked to were involved in their schools or their churches or their sports teams or some work in the community. So they had taken the participation and this more adult awareness to the levels outside of their corporation to enhance their whole community.
And of course, for that to happen, you have to pay workers fairly so that they have enough time to actually do things besides find a second job.
And this company had a system where they expected every worker to make 3 suggestions to improve their processes every year. When they did, and they all did that, when they did that, there was an award process, a profit-sharing process that went with that. Yes, you have to share with the employees. They have to get the benefits.
There seem to be so many analogies between evolutionary theory and business theory, and in both theories and in both realities, you've got competition and you've got cooperation, and you kind of need both of those to some extent to have a really functional system. What is the proper role of competition in business, in your view?
Competition keeps you awake, keeps you from going to sleep and not understanding you have to be as good as everybody else in the world in this process. This company that I talked about that made the 3 million parts, when I talked to one of their managers, he said, hey, we have to do this to compete with our plants, and they have plants all over the world, our plants in Japan and China and Mexico. So we have to be this good in order to be competitive in the world.
Now, is a company that is run with profit sharing, for example, that treats its workers well, that pays them well, that allows them autonomy and decision making, do those plants tend also to be more profitable than the top-down run?
Absolutely.
And why is
that? Absolutely. Top-down run, managers know all the answers, but they know little about what goes on in their factories. This sounds ridiculous, but it's absolutely the way it's run. So when you get workers involved in the process and they know what goes on in the factories, then the process is improved, and then your productivity goes up, then your profitability increases also. So the book that you're talking about that I wrote is really a book about the evolution of a corporation from a top-down to a totally participative corporation. So it's an evolutionary process also.
We're talking to Hal Bolton about his book, War Myths in the Workplace. So do people hire you, for example, or hire other consultants to say, we've got a kind of warlike, top-down company and we want to change it to something that's more fair and that makes more money, and help us do that? Does that actually happen?
What happens normally is that we have a problem, and we called it an illness. There was some discomfort in there. So we would become the doctors to help them with their discomfort. Now, most companies, when we would go in and work with a particular problem, and in a very short time we could clean up that problem, they would say, okay, that's fine, see you later. And we'd come back 6 months later and they were exactly where they had been before, because they had not changed their, what we called, they had not changed their eyes, looking at their work with different eyes. They were just going back to what they knew how to do.
And it's hard to change habits.
It is very hard, and it takes years. The corporation that I was talking about had been working at this for 15 years, and they're still working at it. And they're still one of the best in the world. And they will be one of the best in the world because they're still working at it. It is not a quick change. It is not a quick fix. When most corporations called us in, it was like a doctor saying, okay, take 2 aspirin and go to bed, and you'll feel better in the morning. Instead of saying, what do we really have to change? Because a manager would say, look, I got where I am by doing what I know to do and how to do it. Why should I change?
When you think about what an economy, what a peacetime economy is all about, and what a military apparatus is all about, they're really, really different. One is about making things that you eat and wear and drive and talk to each other with and things like that. And one is about fighting and defending against people who want to attack you. And the idea that we would run both of them in the same way is almost absurd. But if you want to replace the war myths with other myths, what are the other myths? What do you call them?
Well, the myths are just treating people like humans, believing that there is a connectedness between all of us, that everybody is important, that you have value and can add value, and we pledge to honor that. It's a totally different myth than saying, just do what I tell you to do.
One of the problems, I think, in the world we're living in now is that we are so much living in a competitive marketplace, and the competition is intense, and we have ever saturated and oversaturated markets, meaning everybody already has a refrigerator. You don't really need to make any new ones. Then you have to try to get people to replace perfectly good working refrigerators or whatever it is. And this is because growth is mandated in a capitalist society. And infinite growth, as we know, is unhealthy in nature, and infinite growth is unhealthy for ecosystems. And so how do you, looking at things from an adult perspective, think about this problem?
Well, I think you have to look at the whole myth of free enterprise and the capitalist system and who gets rewarded for it. There is room for consumer purchases. There are new products. They are more efficient or more effective. There are refrigerators now that take less energy, that don't take gases that invade our atmosphere. So there are always improvements that can be made to products. Cars run now much more efficiently than they did last year or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So there's always room for making products that are more effective, more efficient, more attractive. And in our current economic situation, there also seems to be plenty of opportunities to make war goods, because we sell more war goods than any other country in the world. Our budget for the military is more than the next 10 countries put together. It's a huge, huge economic dilemma. And that balance has to be rebalanced and changed. And that's why I use the edge of chaos, because we are entering a chaotic situation. And with uncertainty theory, chaos always breeds change. And change always results from chaos. And that is going to have to happen if we're going to get our economy straightened out.
The last level of awareness that you write about in your book, War Myths in the Workplace, is life master, and that's the next level past adult. So you go child, adolescent, adult, and life master. What does that mean, and what is the inspiration for that term and that way of thinking?
Well, I was trying to find a term that wasn't too new agey. And life mastery means that you understand what humankind is all about. You know that other humans are important in the world. You know that whether people are starving in Africa, we should be doing something about that and not just say, well, I make more profits doing this than I would doing that. It's living without mythology. It's living with a sense of total oneness, total connectedness.
So you've transcended your war myths and your peace myths, and you're living without any myths.
That's correct.
And is that from Eastern philosophy or something?
I've studied it all, and it's a combination of many, many philosophies. This is a collection from years and years of having a foot in two worlds, the esoteric world and the practical world.
Do you think that nations go through developmental phases that mirror an individual's life cycle? There are childish nations and adult nations and adolescent nations.
Absolutely. I spent some time with a friend in Africa. We talked about doing some business down there. And you thought you were dealing with a bunch of children. And now they were growing towards adolescence because they had to have an airline. Okay, everybody else has an airline, so I have to have an airline. Everybody else has a steel mill, so I have to have a steel mill. Now we have no raw materials, so I have to build a steel mill for $1 billion. And so that's the growth of an African nation. It's a very large one, not South Africa, but a very large one that was moving into the adolescent stage. Will they get to an adult stage? I asked a question to one of their ministers when we were dealing with their government there. It was about language. I said, Dr. Pubra, you have many, many, many dialects in this country. He said, oh, yes. We have 500 or 1,000. I said, do you think you'll ever get a common language? He said, oh, yes. How long do you think that'll take? Oh, 500 years. So nation development is painstakingly slow. You would hope you could do something faster. Look at what South Africa's gone through. They went to an adult stage. Now they're kind of teetering between adolescent and adult. And you look at Eastern Europe and seeing what happened there, and they now have gone back to a more adolescent, most of them.
What about the United States?
We're totally adolescent. As a government, we are totally adolescent. Now there are one or two statesmen, but they're getting rarer and rarer because of the money issues, frankly, money and power, and that's totally adolescent. And until we break that through and get Citizens United out of the way so we can begin to talk about what real government is like and what government should really be representing, that we're going to remain in the adolescent stage. We may be here for quite a while.
And what economies are for?
Economies are for feeding and supplying humankind.
And not necessarily for 1% of those humankind to get fabulously wealthy at the rest of our expense.
You know, I never figured out, what do you do with a salary of $200 million?
I know, I've thought about that a lot. What do you want to buy?
What more can you buy? And what I found out was that those salaries have nothing to do with their performance. It has to do with what somebody else in a similar position was getting paid. So adolescence again.
Right. The book is called War Myths in the Workplace, Ride the Edge of Chaos to a Peaceful Revolution. Hal Bolton has been speaking with us today, Labor Day. Now, where can people pick up a copy of this book?
They can pick it up from Collected Works. They can pick it up through my website, which is transformingwarmyths.com.
Transformingwarmyths.com.
And I will be at a book show in Los Alamos on September 8th at Fuller Lodge.
And they can at what time?
At 9 o'clock to 2.
Excellent. Well, Hal Bolton, we look forward to seeing you there, and thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.